Hey, Blenders, on this week's show, Tom Holland is confirmed to return to the MCU, Benedict Cumberbatch has The Power of the Dog on Netflix, and Silent Night director Camille Griffin joins the show as our guest.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, Blenders, and welcome. Welcome to episode number 193 of Real Blend, a podcast that we want to dedicate to our friend and former colleague, James Rocky. I will explain later on in the show what that means, but a close friend of all of ours passed, and we're going to get into some stories about him and celebrate his life. So more on that in a second. My name is Sean O'Connell, the managing editor here at Cinema Blend, joined as always by Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago. Hello, Jakey.
My friend. I'm really glad that we are doing that. I think that's very cool. I'm excited to talk about the great James Rocky.
And Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. Hi, Kev.
Yeah, hey, good to see you guys always. I love you guys, obviously. Rocky, I'm excited to talk about him as well because he was one of the first people that was like super nice to me when I first started. So yes. We'll dive into that. He was a very kind gentleman.
A life worth celebrating for sure. But we have a fun show in addition to that. We're going to be talking about Tom Holland and his quote-unquote confirmation to return to the MCU. Benedict Cumberbatch's The Power of the Dog hits Netflix, and we don't agree on that movie, which we will talk about in a little bit. And then our guest this week is Camille Griffin, who wrote and directed a film called Silent Night. Not really a Christmas movie.
It absolutely is a Christmas movie.
It's kind of a Christmas movie. Yeah, it's going to be a tough movie to talk about because there's a couple of things that we can't reveal about that film. But she's a terrific interview, and then at the end of that interview, there's a really, really fun cameo that none of us were expecting. And
it's one of my favorite moments that we've had in an interview. And because of who the cameo is, it was even more special because it could have been one of three people. And it happened to be the one.
So I'd recommend if you're listening to this in some fashion, go over to the YouTube version at some point. So housekeeping. Like I said, if you're listening to us somewhere, but you would rather watch us go through the show, go to YouTube, where we have a channel, and give us a subscription. YouTube.com/RealBlendPremium. RealBlend Podcast. I'll get to the premium in a second. Of course, we are available every place that you get your audio podcast needs met. Have you signed up for RealBlend Premium? When you do that, you get an ad-free version of the show. You get an extra segment every single week that we drop on Mondays, and then a newsletter that I write. And I'm going to do something fun for the end of the year as we get there. So check the descriptions of wherever you're listening to the show and find out how to sign up for RealBlend Premium. We also play a lot of games. We're going to be playing a game on the next one, which we'll explain to you in a second. I also had a Gabe Kovach as well, too, who's doing a ton of work behind the screens. The scenes. Hi, Gabe. Yeah.
We all work on screens now, so.
Yes, yeah. Yes, we do. So the poll this week, that's traditional. We're going into a new month. I want to ask everybody what they're looking forward to in December. I suggested leaving a title off, but I got voted down by everybody. So for December, we have, and Jakey, I'll go to you. Matrix Resurrections, Spider-Man No Way Home, West Side Story, or Other.
And the question being, which December release are you most looking forward to?
Most looking forward to, correct. Okay. Yes. Where do you think the people went?
It's got to be Spider-Man.
Yeah, they went Spider-Man, 76%. That's why I was going to say, leave Spider-Man out, and maybe we'll have a little bit more of an interesting poll.
Right, but what do the other two do?
Resurrections, 17%. West Side Story, 3%. And Other, 4%.
Before those reviews dropped, though.
It was before the reviews dropped, but let's talk about, can we talk about that just for a hot second?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously everyone's anticipating Spider-Man, and that's going to be like the pre-sale numbers are off the charts and it's going to be a ginormous blockbuster. I still fear that the West Side Story audience is not as big as people anticipate it to be.
I don't know what the expectations are. I do feel like I think what concerns me about West Side Story is people seem to be aware that it exists.
Sure.
And we've been talking a lot about it lately because we just did the junket and we saw the film. And so whenever I talk about it with people, they know it's a thing, but the question I get a lot is, wait, when does it come out?
Okay.
And that's not good for a movie that comes out in 9 days.
Okay.
Also, it's interesting. The embargo socially has lifted, and I believe by the time this runs on Friday, the review embargo will have lifted. The film's a masterpiece, and we'll dive into that next week and talk about why. In terms of like anticipation and box office, though, one of the hesitations a lot of people have going into West Side Story that people are like questioning is like, you know, because people love the 61 version and, you know, I think it won Best Picture, right? I think it won 10 Oscars or something. 10 out of 11. Yeah. So people are like hesitant about that. But then, you know, you add the Spielberg factor, which, you know, when we get into the review next week, this is a very different film. And I actually would argue it's better than the 61 film. But that's a whole other conversation. But in terms of, I'm thinking of West Side Story, and I'm only comparing it for this reason for audience. No Time to Die. Considerably, I thought, underperformed for what it should have been, considering it was Bond's last. I mean, it did very well, obviously, overall worldwide, but its opening weekend in the U.S. wasn't as big as, like, Shang-Chi or Venom 2. And one of the things I think we deduced from that conversation was younger audiences are going to the movie theaters and older audiences seem to be staying home. My parents are in their 60s. They have refused to go to the movies. They've waited for No Time to Die to hit VOD or whatever, the on-demand iTunes where you can rent it for $20. I mean, obviously they have a son who's very vocal about going to the theaters, but they also don't want to, you know, risk their lives in their minds.
Your brother's really vocal about the theaters. Good for him.
No. But in all honesty, like, you know, that is a real, it's still a thing. And obviously there's a new variant now. So there's a lot of questions in terms of that. I think West Side Story falls into a category that pitches towards an older audience. And so that's the worry I have about West Side Story is that like the people who are going to go see West Side Story I'm 37. I love the film, but I fear that do you guys agree with me that West Side Story is probably an older audience?
No, it's definitely an older audience. And I kind of think that it's not going to have a big opening weekend, but if they're really smart, they'll keep it in theaters for a long run.
Yeah.
Because if it picks up various critics groups recognitions,
which it will.
Yes, then that will motivate more people who might have been on the fence, who weren't going to go opening weekend. It doesn't feel like an opening weekend type movie for casual audiences, you know, for even people who don't care that it's a Spielberg movie.
Yeah.
I also think the musical thing is interesting because, like, In the Heights didn't do well. And I'm not comparing In the Heights to West Side Story, but
HBO Max.
But still, it still didn't perform in theaters. And we've had situations where films have performed in theaters while also simultaneously having a streaming release.
Dear Evan Hansen struggled.
But is this one of those movies that, you know, kind of skews older and maybe it doesn't have a massive opening, but the audience turns out over the Christmas holiday?
That's what Sean was just saying. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, literally, like that's probably what will happen. I mean, like, I'm telling you right now, I think everybody going into West Side Story has a hesitation, right? Because it's like it's a story we all know. It's a story that we have known for all of our lives. And there was a film in 61 that won 10 Oscars. So that's to me. I also don't know if a lot of people know Spielberg directed it. Like, I've been talking to people. I've literally said, hey, there's a new West Side Story. Oh, yeah. I've said, like, hey, there's a new West Side Story movie coming out. Like who made it? Like, Spielberg? Really? He made a musical?
Outside,
like,
of our audience.
Our audience
knows. Yeah.
But, like, you know, I hope people see it. It's a masterpiece. Please go see it.
I do want to mention, for context, because we talk about In the Heights, which is a recent example, but a different example with the HBO Max stuff. La La Land made almost $500 million as a reminder worldwide. Wow.
Okay. So La La Land,
I don't want to detract from the musical. So I do agree that musicals are a hard sell, but I just wanted to give a little bit more context to that, of like they can be very successful.
Yeah. I don't want to also the fact like there's a strong Broadway crowd
huge
that is also going to show up for the actors who are cast in this movie.
No question. And I want it to do well. I mean, this conversation is purely about that poll we just did where 3% of our audience picked West Side Story.
Back up, and just lately our box office predictions have sucked.
Terrible.
So, but it's going to make $1 billion based on this conversation alone.
But we know No Way Home's going to have a bigger box office. We just know that. But, you know, I hope people, because I've heard a lot of hesitation about West Side Story, I hope people know that it is amazing.
Okay. Well,
yeah.
We'll continue to talk West Side Story as it goes into theaters on the 10th, and the guys can tell their very fun junket stories for that. But in the meantime, we have an interview that is coming up for a movie called Silent Night, starring Keira Knightley and Matthew Good, and it is directed by Camille Griffin. And so she joined us on the show to talk about her holiday film and bring it to the festivals and the takeaway from all of that. And the fun of shooting a film in COVID as the UK was shutting down. I think you guys are going to like this conversation a lot. This is Camille Griffin talking Silent Night on the Ribblin podcast.
Gabriel's gone. What happened to him?
He was our producer.
Yeah, he's the man behind the curtain. He's our Wizard of Oz.
He knows when to step back into the shadows.
Yeah.
And
when
to
stop. Tarantino is a huge fan of Gabe, by the way.
It's true.
He's a big fan base.
I'm sorry I didn't get to see you. Thank you very much.
Camille, we are the Real Blend podcast. We are a filmmakers-focused podcast, and so please feel free to get as nerdy and geeky as you want. I'm Jake, Kevin, Sean. We have 1,000 questions for you, so seriously, thank you for taking the time, and we're just going to jump into it.
Cool.
I'm going to tell you, I pressed play on this film without having watched a trailer, without looking up a synopsis, without really knowing what it was about, and it was such an incredible, organic, unique experience. Slowly trying to figure out what this film was going to be, and then once the realization happens and you realize what the film is, it hits you like a wrecking ball. Like it's just a sledgehammer. I'm just sort of curious, obviously as a filmmaker, you gotta put stuff in the trailer, you gotta tell people what the film is about, but is there any part of you as a storyteller that would just love for people to press play and watch it blindly?
Matthew Vaughn, our producer, when he came on board at the beginning, he definitely wanted people his idea was to market the film that everyone thought they were going to watch a Love Actually type movie, Christmas movie. And I remember sitting there nervously going, you can't do that to people. So I think you guys had a blessed experience. I mean, I don't know if it's blessed, that's the wrong thing to say. I think you had a unique experience because the film was going out through festivals and through links. And I actually, and obviously we had no idea that there would be a pandemic. That was definitely not part of the plan. And I am torn between wanting to talk and make a disturbing film without actually disturbing an audience. But I'm grateful that you had that experience and it didn't destroy you, but I don't want to hurt already traumatized people. But obviously I did want to traumatize people with the film, but not traumatize people.
Sure.
So yeah, wouldn't that be great? But the world's changed. But that definitely was something Matthew always intended. But so I was a bit like, I think we should tell people. I'm a bit more cowardly about it because there's so much disturbing material on screen, which I'm really proud of, but also I'm a little bit ashamed because I'm like, oh, we've got a lot of... Yeah.
You just don't want those audience scores to be Fs on the way out.
I mean, I've read everything that everyone's written, and I can't carry on because I was saying to someone earlier, it's like, not to do myself a disservice, but it's that awful feeling when you're young and you have a really bad one night stand. You're like, oh, I feel a bit sullied and dirty now. Then sorry, that's what reading all the comments are like. You feel go away, go, yeah.
Well, you have three fans on this show right here.
Okay,
so
well, thank you.
So we spoke in Toronto when the film was playing up there at the festival.
I know, and I recognize you because I'm looking at you and I'm like, why do I know Sean?
Yes, you you commented about my Marvel posters over the back because Ben's work on it. Yes, we did. We had a nice conversation, and you had Kira and Lily were both in the room with you.
Yeah, nice to see you again.
Nice to see you also. Thanks for taking the time. And Kira mentioned that you guys were absolutely one of the last people to finish filming before all the COVID protocols snapped down. And we didn't get to elaborate on that because filmmaking is impossible as it is. You're always racing a clock, but with those extra mandates coming down, did it affect how much you were able to film? Did you have to really make adjustments as you were running down to the wire?
Well, when we started filming in February, there was the story of COVID in Wuhan, and my husband was obsessively reading about it, and I was like, it's okay. I mean, it's not okay. It's obviously really not okay, but it's not going to come here. You know, I mean, I remember being deeply affected by Ebola and being very, very upset for people and being frightened. And then it didn't travel as far as we thought it might. And not to undermine anyone's experience. I mean, it's hell, right? But we didn't think it was going to threaten England or the rest of the world. And then slowly it did. And then I couldn't pay enough attention to it because I had to make a movie. And then slowly, as the news was coming out, and we were carried on off, we had 3.5 week shoot. We were supposed to have a 4 week shoot, and then the borders were shutting, and people needed to travel, and Annabelle had to get back, and Lily Rose had to go to France. Well, I was a bit like, what are we doing? I mean, is this appropriate? Is this right to be making a film when every other country in the world shut down, apart from our daft government? I mean, I think you had a particularly daft government, but we had an even worse daft government. So we did wrap early, and we lost there's stuff we didn't get, and we revisited it in the summer, and then Matthew wanted to tag on the Christmas sweater song, so we shot this opening sequence that we hadn't originally shot, and Lily Rose's story was changed, and so there were things that we definitely didn't have. And then how do you then revisit that material when you know what's going on in the world? So it definitely affected it, and I definitely remember at some point going, am I going to be this narcissistic filmmaker and go, fuck everyone, let's just finish the movie? Excuse my language. But I couldn't. A bit like when you were asking about the whole trailer and the how much you reveal, I was like, a little bit, like, I'm courageous in the material, but I'm also a bit also nervous too that people are okay.
Sure.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated in the idea of like having to stop shooting and then picking back up like in months later, right? And the idea of what you do with your cast to get them back into that mindset. Like, do you, like, if you're months out from like a shoot you already did, do you then show the scenes again to your cast to get them back in there? How do you mentally get them back into the character?
Well, luckily, I like to think that the cast believed in the project and liked me and the rest of each other enough that they cared enough to come back, you know. And that costs a lot of money too. We probably spent more money, maybe, I don't know for a fact, but I think a big part of our budget was having to pick up these scenes, which cost much more than they should have cost because people are traveling during COVID and the borders are shut. So luckily, I think the actors believed enough in the project that they were prepared to come, but we had to have certain, like you said, certain protocols in place. But I think if I'd been a different filmmaker, they wouldn't have showed up. and I think they believed that they'd done something a little bit different. But it was there were two things. It was like, what material do we get, and how do you weave in a dreadful Christmas song? Which is, I mean, I love the Christmas song and I hate it. You know what I mean? Like, how do I then make this part of the movie? And I think, you know, Matthew and thank goodness to Bublé, because he's like another, I don't want to say he's a parody because he's a brilliant in what he does, but he's easy to parody a Christmas song when you have Bublé lending himself to it. So there were lots of elements where you're like, okay, well, how can we take all these new elements and make them really work for the film? And what are we risking here? And how do we take care of people at the same time? So yeah, I don't know if that answers that question.
It was just interesting. I find that so interesting.
I want to talk about working with the kids and less about your own personal connection to them, but more about the fact that these kids have to, one, say a lot of words that kids that age are not saying, and also tackle very difficult, heavy ideas and stay in that mindset. And obviously, they're not infants and they are professional actors, but these are really things that kids that age really aren't thinking about. I'm just sort of curious what kind of conversations you have with them off camera to sort of kind of get them in that place, and more importantly, maybe even get them out of that place.
So do you know that the boys are mine? Did you know
yes.
that?
Yes.
Three,
the three of them. So, okay, first of all, the swearing. We say swearing, I think you say cursing. I was just saying to someone earlier, when I saw the film in Toronto, I was like, oh my God, there's so much cursing. What have I done? because in the UK, we swear a lot. And it was only when I was watching it with a different audience, because I hadn't seen the film with an audience. That was the first time I saw the film with an audience, was in Toronto. And I was like, this is really shocking. And we'd also cut half of it out. But my kids, unfortunately, they curse. I mean, not nearly as much as that. And they don't use the C word, just as Kira said. I hope you didn't use the C word. Because that is, that's a no-go.
Is that very British? Is that very British, though?
The C word, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
The F word's like, just like a word that just is in the general vocabulary.
Yeah, sure.
Unless you're talking to the Queen or the headmaster or whatever, then you try to. Right. But I got to a point where unfortunately I swore as a child, and then I stopped swearing, and then I tried to stop my kids swearing, and then we went on the set of Jojo Rabbit, and that completely reversed everything because they were all swearing, and then I was like, okay, I've lost it now. But so I think I went overboard on that, but the idea was that they had a special privileges because it was the end of the world, and kids like to swear, right? And also my kids aren't allowed to drink Coca-Cola, but it was like they're allowed to swear and drink Coca-Cola, so that was kind of two of the kind of special occasion thing. And then the question of how to have the kids feel safe, I think, is important because we did meet other kids, and obviously Roman is a professional actor, and Davida is the little sister of Thomas and Mackenzie. So her parents are both filmmakers, and she's had that experience with her sister. And the boys have become friends on Jojo, and she's talented. They're a very talented family. And I knew that everyone's going to be really mean to Kitty. So I thought, well, I need a kid that's not going to crumble and be destroyed by bullying of her character. And I did meet other children, and I didn't think they were going to cope. But I knew Davida would be fine, because also what you probably know, which I'm sure you know, is that when you're on set making a movie, it's fun. I mean, the scene where Roman's on the bed, not to give a spoiler, but that was hilarious. We did 20, we couldn't stop laughing. I mean, it was a lot of fun shooting that shot. But I don't want to undermine the effect it has, but you're like, come on, Roman, like, you know, and he would be like, stop laughing, I can't concentrate on laughing. But the point is, if we can't have these conversations, I think what I'm putting on screen is that I'm saying that as parents, I don't know if you're parents, but the greatest gift I think you can say as a parent is to tell your children that you don't always know what you're doing and you make mistakes, and that we have to be responsible for our mistakes. So my children have been brought up in a chaotic household, semi-dysfunctional, but there's a lot of love and a commitment. And I definitely don't think it's the way that everyone should do it, but it's the way we've done it. So they know that those conversations are safe to have, right? But I do believe that when we're living in a privileged world, that there are people who definitely don't have the same privileges, and I care about that. And so was it immoral to put my kids in that kind of film? I think it might've been immoral to put other people's kids in it. And I'm not saying because they're mine, I have permission to do that to them, but I knew that they'd be okay and they'd be safe.
Sure, that makes sense, thank you.
Yeah, sorry, that was a long-winded answer.
that was fascinating. It's we appreciate great. It, thank you.
So building off of the idea of conversations in the family, I want to know what happened when you told Ben he wasn't going to be your DP.
Oh, no. So, so Ben didn't want to shoot the movie, right? He was like, I am not working. Because we worked with each other years ago. I used to be one of his camera assistants. We met at work because I was a clapper loader for 13 years. I used to load film magazines.
And, oh, it's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. That's so cool. That's how old I am. They still use film when I was working.
I love that.
Yeah. So, I mean, for years I had like recurring horror dreams about exposing film mags. And when we worked together, at one point Ben said to me, we're going to have to start working together. You're not very polite to me in front of the crew. And I was like, oh, okay, I understand. Okay. I would have loved Ben to shoot it. He didn't want to shoot it. But Ben had like his right hand man who he'd brought up with him in the
Sam Renton. Yeah.
And Sam I'd known for years. And actually Sam and I used to be assistants at the same time. We used to compete for the same jobs. And I love Sam. And I think I also knew in the camera department that DPs don't always listen to directors. And I don't mean that horribly. Ben would argue otherwise. But I think as a director, you have to get your camera team on side pretty quick, right? Mm-hmm. So I knew that whoever was going to shoot the movie needed to trust me or believe in what I had to say and listen. And also because I'd spent years in the camera, I have an opinion. I have a visual opinion. So what Ben was bullied into, not by me, but by Matthew, was to be there to godparent the shoot,
right?
To mentor the shoot, to make sure, you know, he knew we knew what we were doing, but just to be like, yeah, Ben, it's your wife's first movie. Go and help. So he operated the second camera.
Okay.
And he sat in the DIT room and threw a few, you know, Sam, you know, bring it up a bit, turn up, you know, whatever. And then he'd come up to me and go, I don't think you should do it. I'm like, I'm not listening to you. What do you think, Sam? So there was a lot of that going on. We were really lucky. Yeah.
It's almost like the reverse of Guardians, right? Because then Ben shot Guardians, but Sam was the camera operator. And then it was kind of... That's pretty cool. Going back to the family aspect, I found this really interesting because you... live together. So I was wondering, like, do you run lines at home over dinner? Or like, is there, I mean, I know that there's rehearsals and professional rehearsals and things like that, but like, does the conversation come home afterwards and do you work on
That's
it
funny.
At home?
We had the big scene with Roman, and then we got on set and I was like, oh my God, he doesn't know his lines. And I suddenly realized, like, of course he doesn't, because I didn't help him learn his lines. I'd been making a movie. You know, I was always a person to make sure I knew his line. And I suddenly paused. I was like, you don't know your lines. He goes, I know my lines. I was like, no, you don't. So then I had to make sure. So that was something I slightly over. I just assumed someone else would do it. And he wasn't doing it on his own. So, but what I do subject the family to, which I think is a bit tricky, is like when I'm writing, I'm like, can you just listen to the scene, guys? We're having dinner. I'm like, and they're like, oh, do we always have to do this every dinner? I'm like, just 5 minutes, 5 minutes. And then they don't know. I'm like, you have to listen to it. So I did that a lot. I read to them a lot.
Does that help? It helps to hear it.
Children are brilliant, brilliant script doctors because they're like boring. Yeah, why is he saying that? Yeah, okay. they're very good.
Kids are mean.
They're honest. They're honest. Yeah. It's true.
I'm trying to imagine you reading this material at dinner to your kids. I'm just trying to imagine that.
We do a lot of these big interviews that would make a lot of people scared, but nothing scares me more than when I go speak to like middle schoolers or high school kids. Kids scare me.
Yeah, they're really knowledgeable and they really understand cinema much better than anyone gives them credit for. But there's a collaboration in the sense that they tell me when I'm bad or wrong or good, and they don't tell me enough that I'm good. But yeah, I am grateful to have those conversations. Yeah,
That's so cool.
That's fantastic.
I love when characters drop pop culture references in movies. It's just sort of a reminder. I do too. I think it's great. And there's a moment where two characters talk about the film The Road, where they talk about like maybe this is what it's going to be like. Mm-hmm. And I'm just sort of curious about making your characters aware of a post-apocalyptic world and then maybe what like post-apocalyptic films that you thought about when sort of crafting this one.
So I was talking earlier about this very old cartoon film called Where the Wind Blows. And I don't know if you ever saw The Snowman. Did you ever see that film, The Snowman? Mm-hmm. I can't believe you guys haven't seen it, American. It was a cartoon about a boy who builds a snowman and they go flying through the really beautiful Christmas film. Anyway, this guy's a famous cartoonist called Raymond Briggs, and he made a film years ago called Where the Wind Blows, which was a nuclear war movie. It was terrifying, and it's about this old couple who are living in a shed trying to survive a nuclear blast. And as a kid, it was the first time I understood what a nuclear bombs were, and I got it. That never left me, right? I must have been 8 or 9, and I've never recovered from that. And then I tried to watch The Road maybe 20 years ago, and I was like, how old, I don't know, what is it, 15, 18 years old, that film? I was this is bleak. And so those two films have always been a reference of like, that's for me what an apocalypse is. It's monochrome colors, it's bad clothing, it's no food, it's people eating each other. And it's like-
Viggo Mortensen.
Viggo is kind of cool, right? I mean, what a great cast. But so they are part of my horror things. It's like when you think of Tsunami, I mean, like that
the
film,
Impossible.
It was like horrendous. It was devastating.
Oh my gosh. I love that.
Yeah. So so when she says the reference to The Road, I mean, what a great film, but
I love it.
It's horrible, isn't it?
Yeah, because instantly, if you've seen that movie, you go, "Oh, I know exactly what you're talking about."
Yeah.
Camille, I won't ask you to reveal any specifics about the film's final shot, but it's one of these brilliant, brilliant moves that it's going to make you want to go back and rewatch the movie from the very beginning. And so I just want to ask you primarily when you knew what your final shot was going to be. Did you have it from the very beginning?
Well, this final shot's frustrating because, like I said, I'd read everything online. And I think one of the criticisms was like, is this an anti-vax? Does it have an anti-vax association? I don't know if there's any reference to that, but I can skip over that because Kevin's
Well, you said something very smart in our first conversation, is that the vaccine is a way forward and the pill is a way out. I thought that was clear.
I think it's very, very clear. And I'm glad that you pulled that face because you're thinking, oh, I didn't. I mean, this is a socialist film. The kids fighting for care of society. But I'm anti-government a bit. You know, I mean, when governments do the right thing, I'm pro-government. But generally speaking, I think governments make a mess of everything. And I want my children to not be brought up as rebels, but to go, if someone says, do this, you go, well, okay, well, oh, really? Should I, you know, it's like when you say to your kids, would you jump off a cliff? You know, and you're like, why did you do that at school? You're in trouble. Well, would you jump off a cliff if your friend told you to? That kind of thing. So for me, it was fundamental that the last shot had to happen. And it was never supposed to be a twist. Like, I knew the audience would know that was happening. Mm-hmm. So it was never supposed to be a twist, but it was supposed to reemphasize his argument, which is, without being too serious, but I believe in psychotherapy. And in psychotherapy, one of the teachings, obviously the Jung teachings, is that you have to learn to live with suffering, right? And to become truly conscious in the world, you have to learn to live with your suffering. And the boy is like, for us to save humanity, we have to suffer. And the device in the film is to avoid suffering, and which is so typical of the privileged classes. It's like, we can get away with murder and we can get away with suffering. So let's just, so that was supposed to be a metaphor for that, you know. That he's prepared to suffer for the sake of humanity.
Right.
But at one point, Matthew Vaughan said to me, Claudia, his wife, who was one of the producers, Claudia had an idea that maybe that doesn't happen. Obviously, I'm trying to... And I was like shaking. What? And I can't believe you just turned the TV on halfway through. That's Roman. He's just turned the TV on. He had to come and say hi now.
Yeah, please come over and say
Roman!
Hi.
He's just had a fight with his brother, so he's upset.
Oh, no.
What's up, man?
How are you, sir?
What's going on, man? How are you doing, man?
Congratulations on this film.
Thank you. I've just had a long battle with my brothers.
Be careful. Be careful. Oh. Don't expose all our secrets.
Yeah. Over? What were you fighting over?
What was the battle? Yeah, you tell us.
He drank my parties, and it kind of annoyed me.
It's a terrible thing. He drank his fizzy drink.
Oh, gotcha.
Roman, we're sorry.
Those are fighting actions.
When you come to the UK, they have a drink called Purdy's, and it's full of vitamins. It's not like one of those awful drinks that are full of like speedy stuff.
Okay.
But it's like a B vitamin drink. Anyway, they fight over these drinks. And I think he drank his brother's drink.
Does Roman ever throw around, hey, I won a Critics' Choice Award in the house? Because he should, if he hasn't.
But I think he believes he is special because he went on that journey. But I won't tear him down in public. He's very upset.
Does he have the award in his room?
No, it's all in the toilets. Our toilets are full of Ben's awards. I've got one award now. I've got one award, but when people go to the toilet, they take ages to come out. I'm like, what's going on? Because it doesn't have best ventilation in the toilet, but then you realize they've been actually looking at everything in the toilet. all the clapperboards and everything in there.
That's awesome.
What was I going to say? There was one thing I was going to say about, I can't remember what it was. What were we talking about?
Well, we were talking about the final shot. Matthew Vaughn's wife saying it shouldn't be.
Yeah, Claudia Vaughn. Claudia Schiffer, and she was like, you know, Matthew was like, oh, Claudia's got this great idea about the end shop. And I was like trembling. And Roman just happened to walk in the door from school. We were on one of these Evercasts, which is like a Zoom thing. And I said, why don't we, I knew Matthew wasn't going to listen to me. We've had so many arguments about so many things. I was like, let's ask Roman what he thinks, because it's his character. And I tried, I didn't have time when he walked from here to prompt him. So he said, what do you think, Roman? Do you think this should happen? And he went, no, of course. I mean, of course that has to happen. I mean, otherwise, blah, 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 blah. And he went, fine, cool, stays as it is. And I was like, oh, lucky escape.
Brilliant.
Wow.
But yes, yeah. Thank you for asking about that. Yeah.
Yes, no, of course. Listen, we're out of time. I wish we had plenty more.
We have so many questions. I want to, the next time we get you on, I want to talk about like loading film stock, because I'm so interested in that, because I genuinely want to hear stories about that. So we're going to get you back on again.
I
want
to
hear about
the 9 a.m. dance parties to fame is what I really want to get
they
into.
Were incredible. Those dancers. They were so good, weren't they? They're amazing.
But we know you have a very busy night. So we got to let you go. Thank you for coming on Real Blend. We're going to send people to go see Silent Night and to go in it as clean as possible, knowing as little as they can. So.
Okay. Well, I'm really grateful to you guys, and thank you for supporting us. And so much fun talking to you.
Oh, good. Thank you. Have a great night.
Okay. Take care.
We want to thank Camille Griffin for coming on the show. Silent Night is absolutely one of those movies that if it's playing anywhere near you, go out of your way to find it. And we will explain why in the review section of the show. So head on down there.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We want to talk about next a friend and colleague who passed away suddenly at age of 53, and his name is James Rocky. And just to give you guys some context, like the point of this conversation is just to sort of give an introduction to the really colorful personalities that we meet as part of this job. And for the amount of time that you end up spending in junket hospitality suites and in hallways, sitting on chairs, preparing to go into a room, you make a lot of small talk that leads into sort of heartfelt conversations with people who you just run into, you know, from different corners of the world, who all come together for these junkets. And James was absolutely one of those guys who stood out on the junket circuit. And he passed away at age 53 recently after having he checked into a hospital with chest pains and had a heart attack and passed away. And so it was surprising to hear that, because it's somebody who we've worked with for a while. And he got out of the business and went into teaching because he really just got fed up with a lot of the things that we complain about. You know, it's kind of why I wanted to bring him up too, because he suffered through, you know, so many of the things that we gripe about in this industry. Ben was smart enough to just say, enough is enough, I'm going to go do something else. But when he was doing junkets, he was really one of the best. He stood out in a way with the talent that really resonated with people who appreciated his smart questions. I'm speaking for all of us, I think, when I say that watching his junket interviews inspired me to ask better questions. I encountered him at a time when I was still really figuring out how to do this. And hearing his standards for the things that he asked, he was one of the very, you know, earliest ones to kind of puncture questions that you were going to ask and tell you, like, that's frivolous. You know, like, why are you asking that? And almost helped me shape the idea of going after the answers that I want. Right. But he was two things I will always remember. He was exceedingly tall, and so he stood out in every single room, and he was as Canadian and polite as they get. And so he was one of the people that when you went to a junket, you wanted to be in his circle, kind of thing. You gravitated right towards him to see what, you know, he was kind of holding court and what stories he was telling. And I know you guys had a lot of fun interactions with him as well too. Kevin, you were talking about him earlier.
Yeah. So right when I saw the news that he passed, I opened up my Instagram because him and I had stayed in touch over these years, just like in brief, like I have my Instagram open with him right now. And it was in March of 2020. I had put a post up about a record I was listening to, and he just simply said, "Hey, I miss you, man." Mm-hmm. And I was like, "I miss you too, dude. How are you?" I mean, like it was just like, you know, we're in the middle of COVID. I hadn't seen him in years. And just, you know, the fact that he stayed in touch and he would like and talk about interviews and reviews, and like we would DM about movies. And but when I first met him, You know, obviously Jake and I met in 2010 and in DC, and like I just started doing junkets at that point. But Rocky was someone I met like along the way after that, and I don't know why, but he always reminded me of Tarantino. I there was something about
really
his presence. I don't know why. I don't know if it was like a little bit of a look, but I mean, I know he doesn't really look like Tarantino, but there was something, I don't know. I always like thought of Tarantino, and I mean that complimentary, because sure. he was a brilliantly knowledgeable in films. He held conversations. Like you said, he held court and talked about things. He was always kind to me. When I first started on the junkets, Jake knows this. When you're the new young guy, you're dealing with a lot of people who are not nice to you or feel threatened or jealous that you're new or et cetera, not knowing that you're basically there doing it for free for 8 years. They just think you're like, you know, this is some guy from DC or whatever.
Yeah.
But James never talked to me like I was new. It was just, we were just movie got friends who loved movies. I loved his opinion on films, even if him and I had a disagreement. We always found a middle ground in our conversation. He was hilarious in a very, what's the word I would use for it? Like it wasn't like your typical style of humor. There was something, it was so James Rocky. I don't know how else to put it, but it was so James Rocky. Like that guy, there was nobody I had ever met that was like James. It's so awful to hear about his passing. He was incredibly young. I'm actually so happy because Sean texted us today and said, I would like to talk about Rocky on the show. And I'm like, thank you. We definitely need to. And this was Sean's idea. And I'm so happy that we are, because anybody listening to us right now who doesn't know who James is, just look up his reviews.
Yeah.
And you just search his reviews. Even if you don't know him personally or hadn't heard his name prior, you know, the beauty of the film world and the industry we work in is that, you know, movies and things live on forever, just like the reviews. You know, I still read Roger Ebert reviews. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
you know what I
sure.
mean? Like I come across his old reviews all the time. So the cool thing about what James left in his legacy is this idea of, we can still hear his voice through his words. I just always appreciated his kindness and he was always a fan. But he was professional and he's always a fan. That's kind of the biggest lesson I think I learned from him, was that I could be a fan, but also still be professional and still geek out, but still have that journalistic aspect to yourself. And he was special in my entrance into this world.
Jake, do you remember when you met him or meeting him?
Oh God, yeah. It was very early on in my junket tenure. The man was larger than life, both figuratively and literally. Mm-hmm. Just a massive presence, a booming voice, a wonderful laugh.
That's the Tarantino part I'm talking about. Like,
his presence was bigger than the room. A man who exemplified class and dignity, but also demanded class and dignity of others. A man who would not suffer indignity of anyone, to the point where he would call you out if he found you to be rude. He was quite possibly the classiest man. I mean, he's a man who
old school.
Not just made me want to step up my style of interviewing and questions, but also just my personal style. He was always impeccably dressed and would just, you know, just frown upon the idea of anyone, because he took that as a form of respect. He was a man who was all about respect. So old school in his manners. I love. I mean, here's the deal. Look, everyone's got a James Rocky story, but mine is, I walked into the screening of The Dark Knight Rises wearing a Batman t-shirt, and I'll never forget James Rocky in the back of the theater screaming, "Mr. Hamilton, are you really going to be the guy wearing a Batman shirt at a Batman screening?" And I shouted back, "Mr. Rocky, are you really going to be the man that embarrasses a child in front of a group of people?" And he came up to me after the screening and said, he always called me Professor, I tip my cap to you. And here's the thing. Yeah. He is the kind of man who actually wore a cap and would tip it unironically. Yes. Not like as a, like, oh, I'm doing this retro. He was a man who tipped his cap to people. That's the kind of man he, like, that's the class. I'm going to be honest. Look, I'm not going to sit here and try to pretend like, oh, he was my best friend, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But, right. But his passing affected me. Like, that night, I was really, like, after we all texted, and I did the same thing, Kevin. I went back into my DMs, and he and I last spoke in August, and I don't want to, like, lay out, he would scoff at the idea of I think us laying out our private messages, but I can honestly tell you that he said a lot of very kind words about this show. He said a lot of very kind words about the two of you. He was big fans of you two. He was a big fan of animals. He and I would often he would respond to pictures of Daenerys all the time. And I'm gonna end on two things. One is the most beautiful thing that I read about him was it's hard to believe that he's gone because it's hard to believe a man like that ever lived.
True.
And which I think is entirely true. And I'm sure you guys saw, I'm getting chills just thinking about this, I'm sure you guys saw the outpouring of affection and kind words that came out about him after the passing. And let me tell you something, man. If I get 10%, if I get 1% of the kind words that came out about him, well, whenever I go, then I will have done something right in this world. Because
here's my takeaway from that, and I'm really, really glad you brought that up, because what that taught me as that kept going, because I agreed with everything that everybody was saying, and my only hope was that enough people said it to him while he was here, right? So my takeaway was to tell people that I feel that way about them now, and not tweet about it after they're gone.
Yeah.
Because I also read so many stories about him calling people on their birthdays and singing happy birthday. Like this guy was like, he was so dialed into people. Like he was never disconnected in like, we live in a day and age.
He gave up this job, this very flashy job to teach students.
And one of the things that him and I talked about or DM'd about during the pandemic was about how he was teaching during the pandemic, and that must have, you know, doing it through Zoom, and how insane that must have been. But there's something like, I don't know, we live in a day and age, we all have cell phones, being present in a moment now is so hard for a lot of people, especially, you know, for me, and like, for example, I have ADHD and stuff like that. So just in general, but when I was with James, I always felt like he was always listening to me. Genuinely listening to me,
yes,
and genuinely conversating with me, and not like passively talking to me. So, and going to Jake's point, all the outpouring. One thing I think that's really important is like how you treat people in general, right? Mm-hmm. Because you never know who you're going to come across and what you might say, how it might affect that person's life, and hearing all that, just I hope that more people can learn from how James treated people in the world that we work in.
He changed how I operate in it, and I know he changed how we all operate in it. So for people who are completely unfamiliar with James, before this segment, he had a podcast that I hope is still readily available. It was called The Lunch. He did interviews with a number of different people. Please go seek it out. His voice was terrific.
Yeah.
He also wrote heavily for Microsoft MSN. So please go seek out his stuff there.
Cool.
Terrific, terrific voice. So hopefully we turn you guys on to some of his amazing work.
And read his work. Read his work.
Absolutely.
Great writer. Look up his written reviews. Yeah. Yeah.
I can't tell you how much he would despise the fact that we're going to follow up that tribute with a Spider-Man Marvel Cinematic Universe story.
Sean, you would wear a Fantastic Four shirt to a movie podcast, would you,
Doctor,
sir?
Doctor, why are you talking about Spider-Man? So there were rumors that dropped earlier this week, or I'm sorry, not even rumors, quotes from Amy Pascal speaking to Fandango and our good friend Eric Davis, who appeared on Real Blend in the earliest days, where Eric got to talk to Amy because tickets for Spider-Man No Way Home are going on sale, and Fandango got some time with her. And in the course of his interview with her, and he talked about bringing this trilogy of Home movies to a close, and to which she then cut him off and said, let me clear that up for a second. So unprompted, she said, this is not our final Spider-Man movie. We're starting work on the next one with Tom Holland right now, and we're going, she literally says we're going from one trilogy into another trilogy, so this is not the end of our relationship with Marvel. Well, the next story that came out was from a quote-unquote Sony insider, who I will call Mevin Mighty, who said, this is not confirmed, and no one signed up for anything, and I think Amy jumped the gun. So,
how often do you think I'm going to jump in? How often do you think Kevin Feige picks up his phone, looks at it, and goes, son of a bitch?
I think twice a day.
I want to clear something before that gets quoted. Sean is not confirming it was Kevin Feige.
I am not
He's joking
at all.
That it was Kevin Feige. Thank he does not you. Know who this person is.
Thank you for saving me from all the heartache that was going to come from that.
All I heard from what Gabe said was Sean confirms it's Kevin Feige.
Yeah.
Especially
Stop
on this
Kevin
title.
Lying.
On this title, I think Feige is... because the thing is, he's trying to protect a lot of secrets from this movie, and he would prefer, and he's right. He's right in doing this. He was trying to protect the theatrical reveal of the big things that are, I think, waiting for fans in this movie. But this one has been under the microscope more than most. And not only do people want to know stuff about this movie, but they want to know about stuff about where it's going. So Gabe pointed out that I had been saying a while ago that I thought by the end of No Way Home that Tom Holland would be out of the MCU and maybe over into the Sony Spider-Verse of movies.
Or maybe he'd actually go home for a little bit.
For a little while. Yes, who knows?
Spider-Man 4, it's just called home.
I think Tom Holland wants to go home and be done with this press tour. But, I mean, where do you guys stand on this? Do you think it's good that he's staying in the MCU? Indifferent? Would you rather see him go do something else?
I want him in the MCU.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he's the best Spider-Man to ever grace the screen. Here's the thing. At the end of the day, the moment I saw him dropped into Civil War, the moment we saw that first teaser spot in the trailer where, hey, Underoos. And I mean, it's like, was his presence. I will watch 10 more Spider-Man films with him in it.
Sure.
I will say though, I feel
no
bad.
But no more than 10.
Yeah. I do feel bad for Andrew Garfield in a sense, and I don't feel bad for him. I mean, he's obviously an amazing actor, and I wish he had
probably
better
gonna
material.
Win an Oscar. He'll be fine.
Yeah, I mean, in all honesty, if people listening to this haven't seen Tick, Tick, Boom, that's your best performance of the year from an actor that I've seen so far.
It is.
It's incredible.
Did you watch Sing 2 yet?
Oh yeah.
You don't get Oscars for vocal performances.
I stole that joke from Sean.
Thank you very much.
But in all honesty, Sean has kind of and Lauren actually have made me appreciate Garfield's films a little bit more than I did when I saw them. I mean, Sean, you're the one who kind of reminded me how powerful her Emma Stone's death sequence is in the second film, which is a really incredible scene. And Garfield and her play that scene masterfully. Yeah. I kind of want Garfield to get another go at it. And maybe he will. I mean, obviously we don't know what's going to happen with No Way Home, but in terms of Holland, I do fear, and I want Holland to be able to balance this because he's a really great actor. Mm-hmm. Who's genuinely great dramatically. Not saying Spider-Man is not a great dramatic role, but at the end of the day, when he taps into some serious stuff like Cherry and the devil, what was the movie? The devil.
The Netflix one that he
Devil
did?
All the Time.
Devil All the Time.
Even The Impossible.
Impossible was the first time I ever interviewed him. I think he was like a little kid at the time. I'll never forget that. And because he had just, I think Billy Elliot was his thing prior to that, right? He
did
Billy
Elliot
in London.
On stage in the West End.
Right. So last thing I'll say about this is this. I hope that as he continues playing Spider-Man, which I want him to, that he still diverts off and doesn't become his main thing. And I think he has a great team around him. And I think he's a great, I've interviewed him so many times. He seems like a good dude. I just want him to be able to keep his head on his shoulders and not get so wrapped up in everyone wants Spider-Man all the time. Like I want him to grow and be different things, but I'm 100% in with him staying. I mean, I don't see why we wouldn't be.
Yeah.
Kevin kind of brought up an interesting point. Sean, do you think, if this movie ends with the multiverse exploding and there's different Spider-Men abound.
Oh, could Garfield come back and do more separate ones?
Well, I was going to say, they have the Spider-Verse movies. So they have, you know, an animated Spider-Man that they're sort of supporting, and they have the MCU Spider-Man. Is there a world where Sony could sustain two live-action Spider-Men at the same time?
If we're getting a couple of live-action Batman.
Yeah, exactly. Sure. Do you think they could have a full-fledged, whether it's Garfield or something else, where they go, this is our amazing Spider-Man in this universe that is not technically in the MCU, but the MCU could dip into if the multiverse cracks?
Yes, because let me tell you a couple of theories that have come about. And I know nothing, and this is just speculation that I'm hearing across the board.
Why is Kevin Feige in the... I can see him in your windowsill. He's like right outside the
wearing
window.
Wearing his Punisher shirt? You guys see a red light on my forehead at any point, please warn me. I just need to duck to the left. Yes, the Sony universe that is set up there with Venom and Morbius can absolutely exist on its own outside of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And you could say that if it's explained in No Way Home that Spider-Man came over from that universe and he's going back to it, then yeah, you could set up one who's over at Sony and Tom Holland could stay in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And I think people are savvy enough to understand that, that, yes, you could have two operating at the same time. I fear that Andrew Garfield is too old for it at this point now, unless he just plays an older version of the character.
Does he want to do it, though?
He played a 29-year-old Jonathan Larson.
Did he really?
Yeah, Jonathan Larson was 29.
This is a superhero, but he could be a 30-year-old superhero if he wanted to.
If he plays the like Jake Johnson, Peter Parker from the Spider-Verse.
That would be fine. I'd be totally fine with that.
I just loved his energy.
And you're right. When you said he deserved better material, he absolutely... He was the right actor for that part at the time, and he got not great scripts to build a world.
Unfortunately.
So I've heard... The thing that confuses this is that... That mid-credits scene from Venom 2 brought Venom to the MCU instead of vice versa. Mm-hmm. I thought that end-credit scene was going to somehow bring Tom Holland to the Sony side. So then you have to ask, why did Venom come over to the Marvel side if only for a second? And some people are speculating that a piece of the symbiote is going to detach from Venom, essentially, and be in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and then Eddie Brock is going to get sent back to the Sony universe where he was. That 1 second scene or 1 second shot was only done so that a piece of the symbiote could be over in the MCU, and then eventually.
I don't understand that because like if he's in the MCU, he's in the MCU. Like whether if you say he's out there, whether the movies show everyone else or not. In my mind, he's out there somewhere.
Yeah.
Yes. They would have to kind of explain that.
Yeah, like I would say otherwise we're just not going to...
Venom, I think Hardy's Venom's going to be in the new Spider-Man movie.
I think that's what they were trying to allude to.
You think it's going to be in No Way Home?
I think that Hardy...
Well, that was the event.
Show up as Venom.
That event has to be the spell breaking. Like, that has to come up at some point.
You think so?
I can't see that not happening. I would almost bet on it.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Because why else? It's also, they're both Sony movies.
They are.
Technically.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And you don't do an end credit scene that huge.
Right.
For that large of an audience for no reason. And I think your entire question that you just, the thing you just brought up, I think it's going to be solved where you're going to have Hardy dropped into this world somehow.
Or is he just one of the villains that gets fixed? Is this movie going to end with him fixing the problem?
Because right now he's not really a villain; he's like an anti-hero, right? Kind of thing.
But in that end credit scene, Venom suggests that he wants to eat him, so he is he's going to be a villain, but he suggests he wants to eat everybody.
I don't look at Venom as an actual.
But my point being, he's no different than all these other villains who we assume aren't going to be necessarily sticking around because it's the problem of the movie.
Stupid question. So, Venom in Spider-Man 3 was Topher Grace, right?
Correct, yes.
Okay, that's obviously a different universe. But theoretically, if we're in a multiverse, and Maguire and Garf and Maguire can exist in this, and so can Doc Ock.
Sure.
Theoretically, could we have Topher and Tom Hardy?
Yes.
You could have like anything. That's the multiverse problem. Literally anything could happen.
Because the Sandman who is coming over to No Way Home is from that movie that had Topher Grace in it.
Yeah.
And that was Tom, who's the act? Thomas Hayden Church.
Has anyone heard about whether or not the actor Thomas Hayden Church is going to be in it?
I have not heard about him and Rhys Ifans, which makes me think that two characters are just going to be the CGI versions of their villains. Mm-hmm. Like, you'll only just see the Sandman as this big sand cloud and never as Thomas Hayden Church. And the lizard will always be the lizard and not as Rhys Ifans.
Just a little Rhys Ifans shout out. He's so great.
I love these Rhys Ifans shout outs.
He's so great in Notting Hill.
Yes, he is.
That's
one of my favorite performances of his. Like, he's so good in that movie. All right, anyway, so.
Terrific. All right, so we'll be able to talk more about Spider-Man No Way Home as we get closer to the release. But before that, we'll have West Side Story. But this week, we have a couple of movies that are reaching theaters and platforms, starting with a movie called Wolf that none of us have seen. This is not the Jack Nicholson.
Movie.
Is that called Wolf?
It is called Wolf.
Is it?
Is Nicholson in that too? Was a really good Wolf. Like, yeah, it was like terrifying when they did that.
Yeah. Don't give us practical. The rap, Gabe. We're talking about a movie that came out 30 years ago that no one knows about.
Talking about Wolf.
Oh, my bad.
You wrote Wolf in the thing.
You said you didn't specify.
You wanted to talk about Wolf. Well, since we didn't see Wolf, let's talk about The Power of the Dog. Yeah. It's the animal segment.
Hey.
Yeah. Jakey, you go first with Power of the Dog because you liked it more than I did.
Yeah, I really, really love this movie. It is a slow burn of slow burns, but, I mean, just everything about this film came together for me. The performances, Benedict Cumberbatch, it's probably, I would argue, the best performances of his career. Cody Smith McPhee, I think, should really be in consideration for the Best Supporting Actor Oscar. Mm. I thought his performance was phenomenal. Kirsten Dunst is amazing. I love Jesse Plemons. I think he's one of the best actors working today. I still continuously feel like he's not given sometimes the part. Like, he's always great in the parts he gets, but I feel like he's not given the good enough part to really
game night.
Really show us.
I was just game about to say the
great,
same.
Game night's night. Brilliant. And I think he's the lead in Killers of the Flower Moon. I think that's a story that like everyone's talking about how DiCaprio and De Niro are in it, but my understanding is that Plemons is the lead. Anyway, that could be great. Jane Campion's direction,
I think he's Todd.
He's Meth Damon.
Yeah. That's a great.
The cinematography is beautiful. I think the score, it is a tight. Here's the deal: is that so much about this film you don't realize what it is until it's over. Yeah. I wouldn't have called it a psychological thriller while I was watching it. But it's kind of, but by the time it's done, you go, oh, that was messing with me. Like that was doing some stuff I didn't realize it was doing. And look, I'm going to be completely honest with you. Sean and I hopped on the phone after I had the chance to see it. And Sean made me realize a lot of things about the film that I didn't even pick up on whenever I was watching it. And that made me like it more. Now, then the argument could be made, well, should I like it that much if I wasn't able to get it? I don't know. But here's what I'll say is that the more I think about it, the more I like it. The conversation that Sean and I had made me like it even more. It is a slow, brilliant look into what it means to be cruel and why we are cruel. Mm. It's at the end of the day, it's to me a heartbreaking film. It is a tragically sad, sad film. And I just thought it was absolutely beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. I loved it.
Okay, so I'll pick up from there because Jake and I had a huge conversation about what we thought it meant, and he's right. You don't necessarily understand the full impact of this movie until it is completely over. And my problem is once it revealed what it was, it didn't justify everything that we sat through to get to that point. Because you call it a slow burn. It is painfully slow, and I guarantee that if people try to check it out on Netflix, they will punch out in 10 minutes.
I do think the average viewer doesn't last 30 minutes on Netflix.
It's really tough.
Yeah,
it's tough because it does. It's like you say, it's not the kind of movie that if you sit with it, it at least starts to point in the direction of this is where it's going. It's actually broken up into chapters, and Michelle and I went to go see it at a theater. Netflix set it up in a theater for us. And after three or four chapters, by the fourth chapter, like we both turned to each other and we were like, what? Like, where is this going? Like, what is this going to be? And then it finally does crystallize in literally its closing minutes. And then I was like, oh, that's what it was. And, you know, then you and I hashed it out and I kind of, you know, got some more out of it. And I did appreciate it more the more we sort of talked about it, but not enough for me to justify recommending it. And this is becoming one of those films that, like, the more it gets talked about as a front runner in the awards campaign, it makes me upset. It makes me angry because I don't think that that should be the case. I do think Jane Campion's direction is really good. But I have to give her fault for the pacing of the movie and the way that it's structured. So, Kev, you saw it? Did you get a chance to check it out?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I did the junket and everything.
Where are you on this, then?
So I'm kind of in the middle of you two. So my experience with this film was similar in the sense to Sean. So it's like when the film started, so there were things that were happening within the slower moments that kept me in. So like Johnny Greenwood is one of the best composers working today. Did the score for this, and There Will Be Blood. And, you know, he's one of the guitar player for Radiohead. Brilliant guy. And it's masterfully shot. It's like one of the most beautiful films I've seen in a long time. And Cumberbatch is amazing. Cody Smith-McPhee is amazing. Dunstan, Plemons. I mean, everyone delivers strong performances. But I couldn't deny that I did feel the pacing for sure.
Were you ever bored? I guess is the question on it, because like there were. I would say it's a slow movie, but I don't think I was ever bored watching it.
I wouldn't call it bored, but my I think what Sean brings up an interesting point, because once the film ended, I kind of was like, okay, and then it sat with me for weeks now. We did the press junket for it, dove deeper into the thematics with the actors, and I had this Kirsten Dunst and Plemons. They were so great. They were so great together for the interview.
I had no clue they're a real life couple.
If you've never seen them in the second season of Fargo, they're phenomenal.
Yeah.
Okay, which is where they met.
Yeah,
that's they played husband and wife in that too.
And they were sitting there at the junket, and I was like, Jesse, what's your favorite Kirsten role? And Kirsten, what's your favorite Jesse movie? And like they had, I think hers was Like Mike, because I forgot that they were like they both were like child actors.
Sure,
you know, obviously Jumanji and Bring It On for her, but I forgot Jesse was like Mike. He's a kid in that movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You've never seen him in Friday Night Lights.
Yeah,
one of the best characters on one of the best shows of all time.
Interesting.
It'll be Todd for me always. But so what's fascinating about this movie is, it got better the more I thought about it. Like it was conversations. So, and Sean brings up an interesting point. Like, what does that mean then? Because if you watch the film one time and you walk away feeling like it was slow or it just didn't bring itself forward in a way that you as an audience were taking it in. What does that mean about the film? And it's interesting.
There shouldn't be a time limit though, right?
I'm not saying that, but when you walk out of a movie, you know, you have your initial gut reaction, right? And then you sit on it and think about it. Like, for example, with Green Knight, when I walked out of that film, I didn't love it, and everyone else
Hollywood.
Did. I liked Hollywood a lot.
It went from a movie you liked to
my favorite,
maybe
Tarantino
your favorite
movie
Tarantino
of all
film
time.
Ever.
No, it is my favorite Tarantino movie of all time now.
Right away you wanted to see Green Knight again. Like, I would not want to sit through Power of the Dog again.
So what John brings up is an interesting point, because as I've taken a deeper dive into what happened, now I want to see it again really badly, because now I want to watch the film knowing what's happening. But it's an interesting question you bring up about a person's first viewing of a movie, and most people don't watch movies more than once, and not a lot of people have the patience to get through something that is a little more on the slow burning side. That being said, it's a rewarding film thematically if you can let it be what it is and then think about it and then try and revisit it. I think that there's a lot in here that's great. And I'm more leaning towards like the Jake side of it of like, I recommend it, but I haven't seen it twice yet. But I will say that I've been dying to watch it again. Literally, because of the conversations I've had with people about what the ending means. On top of that, Cumberbatch, his arc is so slow burning and so specific that I don't think you can truly appreciate the nuances of his performance unless you watch it and then go back.
Yeah,
and watch
that's it. Interesting. That's a fair. Great point. That's a that's really good point.
There's so much going on there in terms of his, like, one of the things I talked to him about in our interview, he has these very vulnerable sequences where he's naked in the woods and covering himself with mud. And these are all very important character driven, vulnerable moments that speak to the character, but not knowing where the movie goes, those moments might not hit that way.
Right.
So
they strike you as very unusual when you're watching them the first time.
Well, unusual. I wouldn't use the word unusual. I would say, like, I was like, why, what am I supposed to be feeling here?
Yeah. Yeah.
But now that I know, and I relive that scene in my head or those scenes in my mind, I'm like, oh shit.
Wow.
Like, so now I am almost like I need to revisit it because it's one of those movies. But yeah. Sean makes a good point, though. It's like it's going to be a hard sell to audiences to stay with it and possibly revisit it. So I do recommend it, though. It's beautifully shot, beautifully scored, beautifully performed. It's just it is very slow.
I want to hear from you guys as you check
Let
it out.
Let us know. Yeah.
Yeah. I would love to hear from people and see how it plays.
I admire the hell out of it.
For more audiences.
I just don't know if I love it. Yeah.
All right, let's transition over to a movie that it's, again, really difficult to talk about because there's a lot going on in it, and this is not the place for us to discuss it. We're not going to be able to do a spoilery section on this. Hopefully, we'll get a chance to circle back around to Silent Night at another time. But this is a film that Camille Griffin is directing, and she directed it in COVID. And so it's basically set in one location. It's a English countryside home where a family is getting together for Christmas, and it's essentially siblings and all of their significant others and the different personalities that they're all bringing. And you start to realize, like, there's an undercurrent to the reason that they're all getting together. And it's not just the holiday. There's a reason that they're being pulled together. And this is really great that we're doing this with Power of the Dog, because Silent Night is the kind of movie that you know that there's more going on, very similar to Power of the Dog. But with each sort of plot turn in Silent Night, you get more about the big picture, which is what I prefer more about it.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh, it's this movie. And then it went a little bit more and I go, oh, it's this movie. And it just kept sort of going. And again, I can't tell you what the undercurrent is, or I don't necessarily want to dig too deep into what the undercurrent is. But what I can say is that I thought that the explanation of it was extremely rewarding. And that when you get to that, there is a shot, the very last shot of this movie, will make you change your mind on everything that you watched, which I think is fascinating. I think no matter what you think watching it, when you get to the end, you're going to turn around and say, oh, wow. You know,
that's let like me Power rethink. Of the Dog.
Yeah, let me rethink everything that I just thought watching this. And so I'm going to stop it there. But I'm going to say that the performances are terrific. One thing that was really fun that Kira brought up in a interview I did with her earlier, they brought this movie to Toronto and I got to do a interview with her and Lily Rose Depp, who plays one of the sisters as well.
You just dropped something on the floor.
A couple of names.
Can you grab those real quick? Okay.
Yeah. Hold on 1 second. Yeah. Not a problem. Kira said how in the face of a crisis, how the British have a personality that is very much like, no, let's move on. You know, it's time for tea. It's time for dinner. And that humor goes throughout this movie. And I thought that was really, really funny the way that they played it, that even though something big is happening, they needed to keep the peace and maintain stability as much as they could. And that addressing the big thing that was happening would even sort of be frowned upon. And they wanted to keep the focus on Christmas as much as possible. I love that Keira Knightley does totally bizarre Christmas movies that people will argue about whether they're Christmas movies or not. Jake and I even had this argument about whether this is a Christmas movie. But I highly recommend it. And it's one of these movies that probably people are going to be like, I don't even know what this is. Like, you haven't heard about it at all. I would say go out of your way to seek it out because it's...
Without watching a trailer.
Because, it was fun.
Because the stuff that we don't want to talk about is featured in the trailer.
Okay.
And when I watched the film, as you heard in the interview, I just pressed play because we had a screener, and I just thought, well, what the hell, I gotta watch it anyway. Might as well just watch it without knowing what it's about. And what's funny is I was kind of texting Sean as I was watching it, going like, dude, I am dying laughing at work. Like, this is hilarious. Oh my God, this is like, what? It's just a crazy family cooped up in a house. This is nuts. And then about 30 minutes in, I went, oh, this isn't funny.
Yeah,
this isn't funny at all. And let me tell you, when you kind of start slowly realizing what's happening, I gotta be honest, I got so anxious just by the end of it. I just was just so, in a good way, like so uncomfortable and just so like, it's one of those movies that really makes you pause and go, what would I do? Like in this scenario, like how would I behave? What would I say to my family? What would I say to my significant other? What, you know, I loved it. I thought it was great. I hate that we live in a world where, unfortunately, in order for most people to find out about this movie, they're going to have to see a trailer and probably have the bit ruined for them, but that's the world in which we live. But if you get the chance, we're telling about it. We're telling you about it now. If you haven't seen it, I think it's absolutely worth seeing. It's only 90 minutes, which I think is just the right amount of time. If you can seek it out without seeing anything, I think that's the best viewing experience possible. Absolutely. Highly recommend on my part.
All right, let's move on to Keira Knightley Blend. And Jake, keep going. You're up first.
Look, we often have a conversation about whether just because someone's in a movie doesn't really mean it's their movie. It's a lot of big part of it is like, what is their contribution to the film?
Sure.
I'm still, and I gave this a lot of thought, I'm still going to go ahead and say the very first Pirates of the Caribbean.
Okay.
Because it is an ensemble piece, and a lot of people could say, you know, oh, it's Jack Sparrow's, it's Johnny Depp's. Elizabeth Swann is just as much a part of the plot of that film, what drives that film, the back and forth between her and Jack Sparrow, the back and forth between her and Orlando Bloom, and she plays it. She, you know, like Jack Sparrow, I would argue, Johnny Depp as Jack Sparrow is one of the single greatest performances of any actor of the last 25 years.
Mm.
And she goes toe-to-toe with him in not one, in not two, but three different films and holds her own. A lesser actor would be overshadowed by a performance like that. And maybe her performance isn't as showy, but it's smart and it's funny in a different way. And it's strong in a different way. It's all the great things about Jack Sparrow, just in a different way. She's an independent thinker.
Jeffrey Rush, too.
Jeffrey Rush. Oh, my God. Jeffrey Rush. Jesus. Bill Nighy, who was, I would argue, fantastic in 2 and 3. She holds her own and does just as much without, like, maybe the superfluous attributes that her co-stars have, whether it be CGI or more of a wacky character or whatever the case may be. And it's a combination
Davy Jones?
Davy Jones. Who? Inside joke. It'd be really funny if you were part of the show.
It would be.
No, I think she is. I think the very first Pirates of the Caribbean is one of the great adventure films of all time, and I think she is phenomenal in it. And so the combination of the two means that's my favorite pick of hers.
Kev, you've interviewed Jeffrey Rush over the years, haven't you?
Yes.
Did you ever ask him his favorite Joseph Gordon-Levitt movie?
No, but I did ask him his favorite Jackie Chan movie, which was Jeffrey Rush Hour, but Joseph Gordon-Levitt, yes.
Oh my God, that was so great, and I hate you.
wait, this is good. Sean, do yours again.
I'm wondering if Kevin, when he interviewed Jeffrey Rush, ever asked him his favorite Joseph Gordon-Levitt movie.
Oh, this is really hard. Hold on a second. Jeffrey Rush.
I'm going to type in the answer and I'll send it to you guys in chat after he reveals.
Wait. I'm like going through.
Send it to Sean and see if he has it.
Do you got it?
Oh, good. Of course I don't have it. What the fuck?
What? Come on.
I'm never good at this.
No, you're good at these. can you give me? Gabe got it. Okay, wait. Because Gordon-Levitt has so many movies and been working since he was three.
But this is Jeffrey Rush's favorite though.
Can I ask where it is? Can I ask where it?
Oh my God! Where is it? In JGL's career?
I can't do this anymore.
In the middle of
It's would okay. you say right, it's one ahead. Of his high caliber films? You would say no. it's at a no, no. But no, you would say it's of the
it's of a it's of a it's Jeffrey Premium Rush. Come on,
I Come forgot on. About Premium Rush.
Of course you did.
The bicycle yeah, yeah. movie.
Oh my god, I hate this show so much.
Michael Shannon's in that movie too.
Really funny, yeah, yeah. actually. I thought it was a pretty good movie. Actually, to be honest,
what's your favorite Keira Knightley movie?
So this seems like an afterthought now.
Premium Rush.
Yeah. I have Premium Rush. I also I went with a film that has Keira Knightley but and also Bill Nighy, but it's I went with Love Actually.
Oh, nice.
I just first of all I love that film because it is a to me it explores all different types of relationships, good, bad. It has happy and sad endings. It has, you know, it but the part that I always resonated with the most, just from an audience perspective, was Keira Knightley, Chiwetel Ejiofor, and Andrew Lincoln's storyline. Mm. And for people who don't remember, in the film, Keira Knightley is married to, or gets married to Chiwetel Ejiofor, and Andrew Lincoln is the
Wait, have you ever liked any of my exes? Like, is this you, like, low-key being like, this is why
no,
I wrote...
No. I mean it, like, from an audience emotional perspective. But he's filming the wedding, right? And, like, all these close-ups, and she realizes that, you know, and then you have the iconic
More
scene.
More of a self-preservation thing.
Lincoln shows up with the cue cards, and to me, you are perfect.
Iconic. And it's iconic.
The way Knightley reacts in that scene, her facial expressions, she's such a facial... I know it sounds weird, like a facial-driven actress and sure. in terms of like the there's something she's very very good at using facial expressions to get emotions across and I mean and I know that's what acting is but for some reason her face is very expressive mm-hmm. In a very unique way. No one looks like Keira Knightley that I could tell. Yeah, to me that's the ultimate. Like I love that film. I thought she was brilliant in it, and for her to stick out amongst that gigantic cast,
yep.
You know, there's so many people in that film, Hugh Grant, Liam Neeson, everybody. That story has always been the one that I loved. Or and that probably next to the Martin, is it Martin, gentleman who played in The Hobbit, Martin Freeman. Remember his storyline where he's yeah. like filming that sex yeah. scene in that movie, and he falls in love with the girl.
He's a stand-in for
great. Is it, great story.
Is he filming? Okay, that's a good. Is he filming a sex scene for a movie, or is he filming a? Is he a? I thought he was a stand-in for porn.
Oh no, I thought they were like making a movie together. And it was a love scene.
I thought they were stand-ins.
Am I wrong?
No, I'm fairly I'm fairly certain they're stand-ins. My holdup is whether or not it was a regular movie or whether it was porn.
I don't know.
They're definitely stand-ins.
This is great content.
Because he says something about how he was like, oh, I was a stand-in for Brad Pitt on 7 Years in Tibet.
You're probably more right. I don't remember the specifics.
Should we start a new weekly segment? Was that porn?
Was that?
And then you go, Dune? Yes, Dune? It was. so that's my.
Did
that's
you see
my,
that worm?
I like that.
But yeah, that's mine. Love Actually.
Terrific. I really wanted to go with Anna Karenina, which, as Gabe pointed out, I adore, but I couldn't not go with Atonement. Had to pick a Joe Wright movie.
Yeah. Yep.
Joe Wright and Keira Knightley together are magic.
For the record, this was a trick question. This is a trick category.
Yeah.
The correct answer was Atonement, and Sean wins this week.
So. Hey,
hey, it's nice. About time.
5 points for Sean.
It's kind of the movie that everybody. I think Bennett like Beckham was her first sort of recognizable role, but this is the movie where people started to realize like, oh wow, she's really really good. And it's such a terrific. Storyline in that it's a romance where the people can't be together, right? And they each have to sell their different sides of it, and the war that keeps them apart, but also us knowing that the secret that separated them by that damn Saoirse Ronan, 10-year-old Saoirse Ronan, how dare she, from her jealous heart, lying and driving them apart. So you're rooting for these characters, and then Keira, as she goes through the journey of Atonement, just sells every emotion, you know, every complicated emotion that comes with that movie. And I think it's because of the chemistry that she forges with McAvoy
yeah.
early in the film.
I would say in not a good long amount of time. I mean, a very, very short amount of time.
Exactly. But they both are fantastic yeah. and make you believe so heavily in their relationship that you root for it through the duration of it. And a lot of movies have tried that and haven't necessarily succeeded as well as Atonement has. And so... But listen, I said last week that it'd be impossible for me to choose because Keira Knightley is honestly one of my favorite actresses. And I love her diversity. Like Jake brings up Pirates, you know, and we bring up the period movies of, you know, Atonement or Pride and Prejudice. And, you know, that movie she did with Ruffalo, Begin Again, is such great. A heartwarming, you know, just an inspirational musical film. And I love that she takes the chances that she does. I love that she takes the big swings. And she remains one of my favorite junket interviews of all time. Every time you get her, she's
yeah
effortlessly charming. Mm. You know, and it's just, you realize that that's just who she is. I've been lucky enough to interview her a number of times. That's who she is every single time. Yes, exactly. And just incredibly sweet and nice and thrilled that we got a chance to celebrate her filmography. I hope she continues to make movies for the rest of her life. Michelle Garrest, Samuel Thomas, and Logan Wilkin joined me in Atonement. Randy Buss went with The Imitation Game. Kimberly Sue, Haley McCoy, and Sam Anderson went with Pride and Prejudice. Brett said Pirates of the Caribbean. David Block went with Kevin and Love Actually. Christian Hestis, Cam McKinney, and many more went with Imitation Game. It back again. And Brandy Wagner said Domino, which I know is a... Who directed
Love Domino?
Domino?
Domino's great.
Tony Scott.
Is that Tony Scott?
That was his movie after Man on Fire.
That's yeah, terrific. and that was like right when like Tony was getting into that, like those extreme edits and those like Man on Fire was like, you know, yeah, it's awesome. I mean, eventually, yeah, Tony Scott's amazing.
Like it's the style he was flirting with in Man on Fire, and then he was like, screw it, and just turned it up to 11.
Yeah.
For Domino? It's
like, I'm gonna spinal tap this for Deja Vu and Out of Time and everything. All these movies.
Wow. look at you and me, we and us.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for participating in this week's game. We are going to, by putting a little bit of, what do you put it? We're putting out into the world some stardust and trying to will some things into existence by playing hashtag Janusz Kaminski blend on the show next week. So, Kev, have a good time with that one.
No, and, I'm off next week. I can't choose a Kaminski favorite. I mean, especially after what I just watched in West Side Story. Like, this guy is on a different
level.
Oh,
yeah, that's a good... Are you going to be able to see, Sean, are you going to be able to see West Side Story before picking?
No.
I only asked just because that's a very viable answer.
Well,
I will say, though, Sean has seen the best shot in the movie, though.
Yeah, The Shadows?
Yeah. Which is just...
I loved his explanation for The Shadows, actually.
Wasn't that crazy? God,
if you have not seen Kevin McCarthy's interview with Steven Spielberg,
go over Kaminski's filmography. Like, it's ridiculous.
I mean, Saving Private Ryan, Minority Report.
Well, you don't have to do it right now.
I mean,
I'm saying independently.
Guys, Saving Private Ryan, the shutter speed.
Schindler's List.
Doing.
Yeah. Yeah. Hell, he throws out Minority Report just like for the hell of it. Like,
okay, all right. Here's a thing. IMDb game. What are the four movies that Kaminski is named?
Oh, that's funny.
Don't know the IMDb game, if you don't listen to our premium episodes, let me explain the IMDb game. It's, you know, if you look up someone on IMDb, you have all their filmographies, but they always pick four titles.
Yeah.
Oftentimes at random. That say this person is known for these four things. And oftentimes there's absolutely no rhyme or reason as to why it's those four things. And we play a really fun IMDb game. In the premium episode. It is fun. It's fun if you win.
This is a perfect ad for this week's game.
Yes, and so we did it this week. So
we're playing it this week.
Yeah, we're playing it this week, this upcoming Monday. It's a great game. Someone like Kaminski, an endless amount of films to choose from. So here's a little teaser of it. And I'm gonna host this. And Gabe, you have to play.
Oh, okay.
What are the four Kaminski films?
I'm going to go first. I'm going to say Bridge of Spies, War Horse, Catch Me If You Can, and Minority Report. I'm not even sure if he directed Catch Me If You Can.
Kev, you go because I think TV. I glanced at this earlier and I think I have some of them on the brain already.
All right, I'll go Lincoln.
Lincoln Lawyer.
I love Lincoln Lawyer. That's
Lincoln
great
Commercials.
Lincoln.
Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter.
man, this is tough. Because again, like Jake explains, it's never the movies you think it is. It's always a weird, like one of the a teaser for our show that's coming out Monday, our premium episode. We did one with Ivan Reitman. I don't think any of his directing credits were there.
Because apparently he produced Stopper, My Mom Will Shoot.
Yeah.
All right, Kevin, three more.
All right, Lincoln. I'm going to go Munich.
That's a good one.
Saving Private Ryan and Minority Report.
Gabe, you want to cheat?
I think I saw some of these, but I didn't look at the whole thing. War Horse, Saving Private Ryan, Schindler's List, and then I feel like they threw a modern one on there, like The Post.
Gabe proves that if you look in advance, it helps you in the game because he wins.
Nice.
The top four films that apparently he is quote unquote known for: War Horse, Schindler's List,
of course,
Minority Report.
Thank you.
And Saving Private Ryan.
Nice. War Horse. I feel like I saw War Horse out of the corner of my eye. That was the one I was for sure was on there.
Yeah.
The Post should be on there.
Well,
when the newspapers are flying. Oh my God.
There's a lot of movies that should be on there.
If you'd like to hear more where that came from.
Yeah, so our next premium episode is going to be the IMDb game. So if you want to gain access to this and all the episodes of Real Blend Premium, there is a link in the description. I also want to mention, if you want to leave a review for the show, head on over to Apple Podcasts. And posting a review there helps us grow the show.
Yes.
And alerts more people to the fact that we're out here. And while you're doing that review, also recommend us to a movie-loving friend who you think would appreciate the show and our interviews and our very fun segments. Yes, Jake Hamilton.
I would like to pull a Tony Romo and no longer play and just host games.
Interesting. Gabe?
Tony Romo never won, though, so there's that. I don't know if you qualify.
Like to pull a Peyton Manning and no longer play.
Even I knew that.
I might let you host a couple. I like the sound of
Jake
this.
Jake is more the Tom Brady of the.
How disappointed are Kevin and Sean going to be if I just start winning?
The beauty of this game is that it's just guessing. Like it's like there's like that's the whole thing. It's like it's like, but it is strategic because you have to guess. You have to guess strangely.
Sometimes the reality of the game is literally just four titles I can think of with this person. Yeah.
Honestly, do you guys ever just go, what did I interview this person for?
Yeah.
Yes, I do that. All right. Well, you can get that at premium. So go find out where you can do that. And in the meantime, follow us on social media at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, at Sean_O'Connell, at Gabe Kovach, and at Real Blend. We'll talk to you guys next week. What are we shouting now?
Let's do Minority Report.
Okay. Minority Report!
Saving Private Ryan.